Hello and welcome to the Pratfalls Podcast, a show that features conversations with people about the work they make and the life they live. I'm your host, Levi Weinhagen. You can find me on Twitter at ThatLevi. You can find all past episodes of the show on PratfallsPod.com. You can also find it on anywhere you get podcasts. All the episodes are there. Go listen to them if you haven't yet. This is my conversation with Chris Fischbach of Coffee House Press. I really like what Chris does, how he approaches art making, collaboration, literature, and community building. I'm not going to tell you much more. I'm just going to get right into the conversation. So without further ado, here is my conversation with Chris.
So you're Chris Fischbach. And are you the executive director or the publisher of Coffee House?
Publisher. I mean, it's the same as executive director.
Yeah. Yeah. Similar job.
Mm-hmm. Which is, so it's publisher, so it's executive director and artistic director.
Ooh,
so
nice.
It's both.
That's a lot.
And yeah.
Do you have a managing director? Is there someone who does the...
Yeah, my number two is Caroline Casey, and she was marketing director, and she's managing director now. And so she does a lot of kind of upper-level strategy stuff with me, and then in terms of... And then she manages a certain amount of the staff, and but then we have an accountant who does a lot of the financial stuff. Mm-hmm.
I have a vague sense of what I would think the head of a publishing company does, but it's vague, and mm-hmm. I don't know how much of that is because that job does change day to day, or how much of it is because no one talks about that. Like, when people talk about writing, they talk about writers, not, and maybe editors. So I'm curious for you, like, what is your relationship to the actual written piece, like... How much of it is you just love to get a writer in front of a reader? And how much of it is, like, do you feel like you're directly doing that? And how much are you doing sort of the sideways parts of making that happen? Does that make sense?
I think we're, or not maybe. I mean, it's, we're connect, you know, we're like the, well, sometimes people say they're the, we're the midwife kind of thing.
Oh, yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's a good description. And so it's, you know, not... entirely necessary, but a good idea.
Yeah, it would suck without, like,
right.
The pain would be greater.
Right, yeah. And so it's, we make, help to make the work better, and then we, if you're just doing, you know, self-publishing, for instance, then everything is on you, and you don't might necessarily have a lot of expertise.
Yeah.
But we are professionals, and so we have connections. We know what we're doing with design, editing, marketing, and just the relationships we've built with vendors and bookstores and our reputation over the years. So it's, we provide all this.
You create a path for the whatever the book or the product is.
Yeah, and then what we also do at Coffee House or at a smaller place is that we provide a context, an aesthetic context. So, like, if you're with Random House, you might be one of 100 novels coming out. But at Coffee House, you're going to be one of 4 in the season. And they're going to be kind of aligned aesthetically somehow. Hmm. And so that means that booksellers and reviewers will have more of a sense already, just that they see it's a Coffee House book.
That's interesting that being with a smaller set of folks can actually make it easier for... those sellers to understand what the book is, then mm-hmm. you'd think a big company would have a lot of sort of marketing muscle to help tell you this is what this book is.
They
you
do
get
have
lost in the shuffle, I imagine.
Yeah, they do have a lot of marketing muscle, and they can make that happen. You're seeing it right now with kind of George Saunders.
Yeah,
is a great author, nice guy.
And he's been around forever too.
Yeah, and he gets they throw a lot of marketing muscle behind him, and you know there are others too, and they can do it, but it's you have to in any publishing house you have the you wait to see who the winner is going to be or where people are paying attention, and then the marketing muscle goes toward that. Whereas at a smaller place, we try to even that out and do things differently. We just don't have the money to do that either.
Right. So you have to be creative. Mm-hmm. Can you a little bit more talk about what specifically Coffee House Press, like what it does and what is its aesthetic? Because I have a sense of it, but I wonder how you talk about, like, who is Coffee House? Like, what does that mean?
Right. Well, I'm trying to remember. I just rewrote our mission statement.
This is kind of unfair of me.
I don't have the exact wording, but it's Coffee House Press creates spaces for audiences and artists to interact, inspiring readers and enriching communities by expanding the idea of what literature is, what it can do, and who it belongs to. Okay, that's good, because I could never remember that. That is the mission statement. And I think the idea being that we now move on to the vision statement, which is just like, you know, to be the premier nonprofit literary publisher in the country, expanding ways that literature is distributed and experienced by people, and then hoping to make literature more relevant to more people by evangelizing our innovations. But the overall aesthetic, I guess I would say, is, you know, border crossing, which is genre crossing. It's experimental, innovative. It has part of the mission that says who literature belongs to is that we try to publish as many different kinds of people as possible. We want literature on our bookshelves to look like the country itself. And so that's kind of how we're known, is uncategorizable.
Yeah.
In many ways, it's like when one thing I like is when I hear a bookseller say, I don't really know how to describe a coffee house book, but I know exactly what it is. Mm. When I'm holding it, I was like, yes, this is exactly it. Because I'm not quite sure how to talk about this.
Yeah. But that seems harder to market.
Yeah.
I mean, because I have that same relationship to your books where I'm like, this is a coffee house book. Like, I can see a book and not see the coffee house part right away. And I'm like, this feels like it's a coffee. And it usually is.
That's good.
Yeah. But I don't know how to communicate that feeling.
Yeah. And or when I go to Frankfurt Book Fair, so I'm meeting other editors who are pitching me their books. Mm. What I will say to them is, I want you to tell me about the books on your list that you love so much, but that no other publisher will touch because they're afraid that they won't be able to sell them. Because I want to sell those books.
Yeah.
And it's risky, but it's fun. And I think we used to shy away from that sometimes, like during financial problems, you know, like, oh, maybe we should sell something that's a little more commercial or not as quite as weird. But then those books actually don't do as well. And so it's really like double down on our aesthetic and don't apologize for it.
Yeah.
And our readers are there.
That sounds very similar to me to this idea, especially now in sort of the modern digital direct connection to your audience world of artists approaching audience development with find 1,000 people who will like deeply love what you make is way more powerful than 100,000 people who are largely passive.
Yeah.
Is that similar to this?
For sure. We don't need to sell hundreds of thousands of books. It's like if I had to sign a contract that was like, you will sell 5,000 copies of every single book you will publish, I would probably do it, because that would be a success across the board every time. But it wouldn't be, we'd have to give up the occasional selling 20, 50, 100,000 copies. But, you know, that core 5,000 is crucial. If we could get that and then build on it, it would be fantastic.
Yeah. Well, I would love to get into your relationship to books and writing and reading, because your job is not to write books. Your job is to find those people and, like you said, sort of help them birth their babies out into the world. Where can you track your relationship to your love of literature and people reading literature?
Like from my youth?
Yeah. I mean, were you a heavy reader? Were you writing?
I didn't. Well, in junior high or whatever, elementary school, high school, I didn't consider myself someone who was always reading. I didn't read a ton. No one ever said that's a nerdy kid who goes to the library all the time. I went to the library.
Yeah.
I did read. But it wasn't, that wasn't what I did.
Wasn't your identity.
Wasn't my identity.
Yeah.
And I didn't write. And then in college, I decided to become an English major. I thought I was going to be poli-sci, but then I took a boring class. And then I took an interesting English class and really liked it.
Oof,
and
your whole life hangs on that one professor.
I know. I won't say who he was. It wasn't Paul Wellstone, because he was just left.
Can't imagine teaching a boring class.
No, I wish I would have had a class for him. And so then in college, I got interested in, I started to try to write, and I did write some. And by the end of college, I was like hardcore English major and was writing all the time. You know, I bought a manual typewriter and all that. And I was into like beat literature and all that kind of stuff. I was like the typical like 21-year-old English student, and you know, like lots of coffee and cigarettes and just stupid. But then I graduated and I applied to go to the U of M creative writing. It wasn't MFA then, it was like a hybrid master's in English creative writing. And I didn't get in. And like now I know, because like most of my stuff was bad.
And it's a small group of folks.
Yeah. I mean, I think eventually I probably would have gotten into somewhere.
Yeah.
But then I was still writing, and I didn't know what it meant to be a poet or anything. I didn't have any necessarily career path. And so then I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't want to teach. And then an alumna told me, oh, there's all these great publishing houses. Are you interested in publishing? And I said, maybe. So yeah, I took internship at Coffee House. I applied to Coffee House and Milkweed and didn't get the Milkweed one. And like the Coffee House one, I didn't get the normal internship, but we have letterpress. We had letterpress internships. And so they offered me that and I did it. And so there I continued to read and write poetry. And I learned from Alan Kornblum, our founder, about how to typeset, you know, lead type one letter at a time. And he was also a talker and a storyteller. So I kind of got an education in that back press room from him. Then there was a normal internship, the editorial and marketing altogether, which I did. And then I kind of did another one on top of it. And then they needed like someone to do $5 an hour database entry. So of course I did that. And then the editorial assistant quit. And I applied for the job and got it. And then ever since then, it's sort of, I just rose up through the ranks. And a big thing that happened was there was an ED and a publisher then when I was first hired. And so Alan was more of an artistic director, but then the press couldn't afford both. So he became publisher like I am, which meant I had a lot more editorial duties. And so a lot of times in a small press, editorial rises to the top. That's like generally the path because it's a vision-led organization.
And that's, I mean, to driving the aesthetic and the, the actual content.
And you're also proofreading all the grants and the marketing materials.
Right.
So you're learning that. So all, you know, the first few years of working there, I continued to write and I became interested in public art and performance. But then gradually, I think I saw also that I wasn't going to change the world of poetry. Like I wasn't that good. I was fine. Like, I could probably get a book published because I knew how to do things.
Right.
But it wasn't important to me any longer. But I think that rather than say that I gave up writing, it's more that both I found creative satisfaction in editing, but also that I think a lot of the gestures that I make as an arts administrator, I think of as artistic gestures. So I think artfully and in an art context when I'm making decisions. Maybe financial ones, but more around like strategic around programming and that kind of stuff. So I still consider myself an artist in that way. It's just I'm not writing.
Yeah.
But
it made me think of like a dozen questions, but one, you mentioned that early experience with setting type.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you can talk about how that maybe changed your relationship to books, that awareness of that level of human interaction with the making of books. Did it have an impact in that way?
It makes you hyper aware of artifice, I guess. I mean, or that, because it's one idea that in a lot of art, but in literature, at least in my field, is people don't necessarily want to see the art. They want to look past it and escape.
So they can put themselves in there.
Yeah, into a story, which is fine, and that's great. But that's not something that informs my aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm interested in realizing that I am experiencing a work of art. And I think setting type that way, like one letter at a time, brings that out. And it also informs the idea of space on a page. Mm-hmm. And so thinking about not only is it artifice, but it is physical space, and literature isn't usually thought of as that way. It's storytelling. I mean, it's a book, maybe, but it takes up it's physical, I guess is what I mean. Like there's something there. And so that was a transformative moment for me, I think, is making the connection between, or deciding that it was physical and spatial. I think that probably led me to think a lot about the different ways that literature can be experienced in the world. And then that combined with some of the interest in public art kind of led to some of our new kinds of programming.
Yeah, because one thing you're doing, it's Coffee House Press, but it feels like, I mean, you're the guy, so you're either either just saying yes and often saying like, oh yeah, how can we play outside of the normal mediums? Because thinking about publishing on like a coffee sleeve doesn't seem profound in some ways because there's text on coffee sleeves a lot.
Sure.
But then at the same time, people would say, but that's not publishing. So in that way, it does feel like you're upsetting how people think about, is this literature?
Right. Well, that's one thing we say in a lot of our books is literature is not the same thing as publishing. Mm-hmm. And we're in the literature business. And publishing is one thing that we do to connect readers or to put that art out in the world. You know, one of my favorite things that we did that illustrates this is we published a book by Andy Sturdivant, who's been on your show.
Yeah.
And it largely, I mean, you know the book, but your listeners might not, is essays about walking around cities, about public art, about his experiences, personal essays, but really about city as artistic medium, I guess, is a good way of putting it. And so we got a grant from a local foundation that we hired or commissioned, I think, 10 different artists who work in the public realm in Minneapolis to take an essay and turn it into a public art project. So one of the essays was about the art world kissing, which is like, you know, kissing hello. Like maybe you don't know how to do that, so here's a lesson. And so Supergroup, the local theater troupe, they took that essay and they did kissing lessons on the light rail platform, like to anyone who showed up or was in the in the train.
Anyone willing, essentially.
And was willing, yeah. And then one other thing we did, there's an essay called Walking to Matt's Bar in a Blizzard. And so where Andy goes to Matt's Bar in a blizzard and sits and listens to some Roxy music and has a cheeseburger. And we, the people who worked on that one were Chris Koza and Kate Casanova, a musician and a video artist. And so they created this cool sound and videoscape of found footage, like from TV shows, of that particular blizzard, and then also made a kind of soundscape to it. And the idea being that we, on the first heavy snowfall of that particular year, we would meet outside of Matt's bar and project it onto the wall. And play that for all the people passing by and then go inside and eat cheeseburgers. And so everyone who kind of even saw that video passing by and was confused by it had an experience of literature, you know? And that's legit. And so that was, those kind of things I think are fun and interesting ways to think about how people can experience literature, how literature can be transformed and where it is.
This comes from a very, like, personal experience place. I, as someone who, like, identifies as a comedy maker and loves comedy and deeply believes in the artistic practice of comedy, I still see a lot of struggle around having to convince people that versions of comedy are art and not something else. And I wonder how often you bump into that, because you are doing something that is half the time the obvious fine art quality. Like, even just, there are people doing things with typesetting right now that is about the words, but it's also about the representation of the words, and that is accepted by these sort of big literary art circles.
Yeah.
But I wonder how much you get people wanting to say, we need to have a discussion about whether this even counts as literature, or what if this is outsider art and so outside that it's nothing. And, you know, how much are you engaged in those conversations? How much do you think about that before you move forward with something?
Well, so I first had to start talking about it with my staff.
Yeah.
And so there's staff and board.
They have to be on board.
And board.
Yeah.
Board directors. And so that was, and then people who want to participate in it, the artists. And like, luckily here in Minneapolis, there's enough people kind of thinking outside the box, I think, because of very social practice and open field and stuff. But it's, we have a hard time convincing funders to that this is kind of an additional thing that we might need funding for. Some people get it. Like, if I can sit down and talk to Vicki Benson and the McKnight Foundation for an hour, like, she got it. You know, she understood what we were doing. But it was, I already had a relationship there and she was, you know, willing to listen, and she's great. But it's when I'm trying to find different kind of funding, I think it's a lot of, what is this? And no, we don't fund books, you know, it's not an easy thing to understand immediately. Mm-hmm. And so, and as for like the rest of the, like the literary world or publishing, like, I don't really care. That's not true. I think that if literature doesn't evolve the same way that if drama or theater or orchestras don't evolve, that they will become less relevant to people. And so we are trying to adapt and make things more relevant for people. And other people who work in literature should be doing that if they want to remain relevant to a broad swath of people. Mm. And if I'm a part of our goal is to put it out there and for other people to see, and maybe other people will start doing it as well. So if they don't want to, then that's not my problem. You know, they can go, like, just be a publisher and just publish books. Yeah. That's fine. Like, there's a lot of, that's not going to go away. But this is interesting, at least to me, artistically. And I think it's important because I think literature can have more of a, or already does, impact on the culture.
Mm-hmm. There is a piece where if you're not wrong for what you're doing, I think some folks who are locked in a certain way of thinking see that as, well, that means either I'm wrong or they're wrong. We can't both be doing something that are distinctive. And it sounds like most of you are like, yeah, I mean, that you can be worried about that, but I'm not worried about that.
Right. I mean, I don't. And again, like, we still are publishing and we're not going to stop publishing. Mm-hmm. So if someone is just publishing, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you need to be doing anything. Not everyone needs to be doing weird, arty stuff with literature. Or, like, it's not so arty, but, like, engagement, yeah. And that's fine. I think probably the funders who get it might be asking other people, like, hey, are you doing anything weird in public engagement like Coffeehouse is? And I'm sure that's annoying.
Yeah.
It's helped us, certainly, with State Arts Board and McKnight and the NEA, because I think some people do get it, and they see that we're at least trying something new and different. It helps that I think I've attended all sorts of... I've been on grant panels, mm-hmm. you know, I sort of know how to do foundation speak, and I see how what we're doing can fit into a logic model and all that. So it's not just being a renegade and trying to go do stuff. It's actually then understanding, well, like, X Foundation doesn't, I don't deserve their money. Like, I have to show them how what we do actually does fit into their goals. Mm. And that's just about kind of shuffling words around into different parts of different applications.
Well, doing the work of really understanding what they're about as well.
Yeah.
You mentioned relevance, and I think this ties into that. You know, I actually recently had Nina Simon mm-hmm. on, and she has The Art of Relevance, which I really enjoy that book. And one framing I enjoy is she calls out people who spend a lot of energy trying to convince everyone they're relevant, and that's how they think of their marketing and their audience development, versus the idea that you have to see if you truly are, and if not, you maybe have to move a little bit to where the work you're doing is relevant. And it sounds like that is sort of an idea that's at play here of, we're going to go bring this kind of literature out into this space where people already are existing, because that's where the relevancy lives. Do you have to ever wonder, it doesn't sound like it's a big problem, but is there any evaluating and assessing ongoing to make sure you're not just trying to get some attention to drive people to buy the books?
Well, we've always said that this is, because a lot of people think, oh, you're just doing marketing for your books.
Like, and stunts.
Right. And we insist, well, A, we work with plenty of artists who are not our authors.
Yeah.
So there's no actual commercial.
If you were doing that, you're doing it poorly.
right. And so we're saying, no, this is content. Like, it may have an impact on sales, but that's not why we're doing it. Nina is, I mean, I read Art of Relevance too, and I saw her great talk at the History Center about relevancy. Yeah. And actually, that a lot of that helped me with, that gave me some vocabulary to kind of talk further about this. I wasn't necessarily using the term relevant before.
Yeah.
But I was like, oh, well, that is exactly what I meant. Thank you. Thank you, Nina. And also making a low bar of entry is one that she talks about that too.
Which I love.
And so I think that's the other thing is, like, okay, if they're not going to, It's quite a thing to actually just go to a bookstore, find a coffeehouse book, and buy it. Like, that's just, like, the odds of that happening in our country are very low, right? So it's It does happen, obviously. We do lots of things to make it happen.
Yeah, but you have to make that as easy as possible.
Right. So then it's also like, well, let's go out into the world and be external facing. And then if someone sees something happening or experiences them in a billboard or in a coffee sleeve or something like that, that's going to make it more likely that they may find its way back to a book, or that it's also a legit experience of just having a cup of coffee and reading a couple lines of poetry. I mean, you know, some people ask me, are you just doing this stuff for grants? And the answer is, you know, absolutely not. Because, I mean, it's helped with some, but it's not like suddenly we have all this new funding coming our way. And let me see, did I answer the question?
Yeah, I think you did. Okay, I mean, it sounds like you do make, just because of the way you're approaching the work, that's not a big issue. Because
Right. You're
not even thinking of it as primary practice to be driving people to make purchases. That's not the reason.
So one thing that we did, because I do have to think about, if you run an organization and you pay people when they have insurance, like, you have to have revenue.
Yeah, that's irresponsible if you're not.
Right. Is there a revenue model for this? Like, what if we are providing relevance to something, how can that be made into revenue?
You know,
not necessarily profit, but just how can it pay for itself?
Right.
And so a couple different ways are that if we can do these, one thing we do is do these residency models where writers go into a space, they're there to be creative, to shine a light on that space, that archive, that library, and then they collaborate with that space to create new art. And so we've done that 30 sometimes now, and we've done it so often and also track evaluations and all that for it, that we were able to attract the Hennepin County Library was like, well, you should do that in some of our libraries, and we have legacy funds. And so basically, can we hire you to do this in our library? And so we've done that 3 times. And that's a model, a revenue model.
Yeah, that's like direct services, kind of.
Right.
Yeah.
And so that is kind of longer term thinking around strategies for that is like, okay, that's part of it. And then also, can we create a kit? Some kind of kit that allows people that we don't have to run it, and other people can get this some kind of kit for whatever, how much that costs, I don't know. It just tells them how to do it as best practices and evaluation tools and all that kind of stuff. But then the other thing is that sometimes there's like a circle diagram that we think about where we have our books and our projects and books and projects. So one project was that we were very active with Little Free Libraries and giving them books. And then eventually we worked with Little Free Library to create a book about Little Free Libraries. And so that the project then turned into a book. And so that's the idea, is that sometimes our books will turn into projects, sometimes projects will turn into books. And sometimes they will just be projects and just books. So that's also how I think about the revenue for it. In addition to trying to figure out, is there a donated path or is there some kind of crowdfunding or membership path.
Yeah. Because if you're building people who are invested in the idea of what you're doing, what is the return on that investment?
Right. And this is like I said, we're going through strategic planning right now, and I don't know the answers to this. And partly it's been, there's no model for what we're doing in publishing. And so it's trying a lot of different things and seeing what sticks and then evaluating them and kind of moving forward. So I have a kind of managed chaos management style, which I'm fine with. Not everyone is fine with it, but I don't. And then I think it's just figuring something out, following it, the success, and having faith that it will be okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have to make a decision and then justify the hell out of it. Spend all your time making sure it was the right decision.
Yeah. Yeah.
I am curious, because you took over, was it 2014 or 2015? When did you move into the...
No, 2011.
Oh, okay. Sorry to cut years
that's
off
okay.
your tenure.
Well, Alan died in 2014.
Okay.
That was
popping in my brain. But you took over something from the guy who started the thing.
Yep.
And there are plenty of people who come into a leadership role after that's already happened. You know, you're not the transition from the person who started it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a very specific relationship, and you worked there already, so you had a relationship with Alan. So I wonder what you were thinking in starting the job you have now. Like, if the pressures were specific around nurturing the relationship with Alan, as well as you're protecting something that means something to this person, that can also be a reason to not try new things, because there's there can be the implication that I'm trying new things because you were doing it wrong. I don't necessarily see that, but I think you give anxiety about that. So I wonder how you've thought about your job as steward of a thing, having known really well the person who made it real.
It's, he got sick shortly after I took over. Mm-hmm. So he got cancer and struggled with it for 4 years, and then died. So it was, in one hand, like, he was very hands-off. Some part of, with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, you can be very healthy for a while, mm-hmm. right? And so he was. But he was surprisingly hands-off with me. I was just surprised, and I'm really proud of him for being that way, because I was worried that it would be difficult.
And he was still kind of on as a founder. Like,
he was on staff. Still,
yeah.
Yeah, he was contract with the board for a set amount of money for a year, that sunsetted after 5 years. Mm-hmm. And let's see, he didn't really have the energy. So there wasn't, I don't know what it would have been like had he been really healthy and active and wanting to work there for 20 years. Because I think part of his plan was, I'd like to work here for 20 years. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to deal with that, you know, sadly.
Yeah.
But there's, you know, sometimes one thing I had to do was differentiate myself from him. You know, there was a certain amount, like, I'm a very different person than he was. Mm-hmm. So people who knew both of us knew that already. But in terms of being a leader and kind of setting, resetting, you know, you reset your iPhone, it's mostly still there, but it's fresher and different or something. Yeah. And then I also needed to see that I needed to differentiate Coffee House from Grey Wolf and Milkweed here in town in terms of that. And so it's part of what I could do is some of these new ideas that I have. And it's funny because one time Alan said to me, you know, I can see that what you're doing is kind of an offshoot of what I was proposing for something on the website. And I was like, yeah, I don't think that's true. But I was like, yeah, I can see that.
Yeah, right. So, and you're better to let that.
Right, yeah, yeah. I mean, it didn't matter. Like, it was, and I was actually glad that he was able, that he thought that. Because, yeah, I could have been like, what are you doing? Just publish books.
Yeah.
You know, because that's what's important to him. I think if I had veered too far away aesthetically, or if I had said, for sure, like, get rid of all the letterpress equipment, you know, we don't want that anymore, there would have been problems. But there was enough of an overlap in our aesthetics that he was happy with it, I think. We always had an agreement ever since I'd been on staff for about 5 years that we could each like, if one of us didn't like a book that the other wanted to publish, that there was, like, one book a year that you could always, like, it didn't matter. Mm-hmm. Like, I could put forward a book and say, we're going to publish this, and he wouldn't say no, even if he hated it.
Yeah.
And so, but there also was, that didn't really happen. There was enough of an overlap that, but then it shifted, and it's, one thing that's hard is the people who didn't overlap the aesthetics, who are no longer on the list, and that's really tough. It's harder on them than it is on me, but it wasn't an easy thing for me to do. Hmm. Because there's a lot of anger when you have transitions and things change.
How do you think about it now in the idea that you are responsible for somebody's legacy? Like, is that on your mind much? What role does that play in your...
I don't know how much I think about it. I guess I trust that I don't have control over it, maybe. I don't think he would have a problem with what I'm doing. I think it's consistent with what he did and what he wanted. And so that will be for someone else to decide, I guess. I don't really worry about it. I think sometimes his wife, Cinda, comes in and, you know, picks up books. I talk to her, and I think it's then that I kind of think. Yeah. I'm like, oh, is she... I hope I'm doing okay. I don't want Cinda to be mad at me. But she, you know, seems great. And, I think that there will be... There was a certain amount of time where I had to not talk about... If I wanted to make the press kind of my own, where I didn't talk about Alan a whole lot. It was about, like, that's the past, this I'm about now and going forward. But I feel like now, or for a while now, it's been like, okay, I think I don't need
You've
to worry.
Established
I don't need to worry about that anymore.
Yeah.
So it's... I think I'm an okay place for that. I think there's still some work to be done on securing his legacy in the public realm.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm trying to figure out how to do that.
I wonder if this is not a, this has not come from any underground rumors, but I wonder if you, another thing that is hard when you're leading an organization is often we don't plan for what's going to happen when I'm not here anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not planting the seed for you leaving. You're young. You have a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
How do you think about that? Because you had such a good transition for yourself, and how do you, you know, you want to, I would imagine you want that to be true for whatever would happen after you're not there.
Yeah, we, and he, to his credit, he put the transition in motion, which a lot of founders don't.
It took a while.
Yeah.
Intentionally, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
And that a lot of other publishers, he would talk to them about it, old guys from his generation, and they didn't want to talk about it. And he was so mad because he's like, all those books are just going to go out of print.
Yeah.
So it's something that actually that will be an important part of the legacy, I think, is that sometime soon, yeah, like I need to talk to the board. Like we have to have just like a general
right. I don't want to freak anyone out. I'm not right. announcing anything, but yeah.
Right. And it's interesting because some of them asked me, you know, do you get job offers? And I said, well, there was only really been not an offer, but one conversation that happened that I didn't talk to them really.
Yeah.
And they're always like, you should always talk to people. So the board, even like there's people on the board
yeah.
who like encourage that, but they're not encouraging me to leave.
No.
But because sometimes those conversations just reinforce where you want to be.
Totally.
Sometime soon there'll have to be some planning around that, both, you know, emergency. At the first, there should be some kind of emergency plan.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's funny to not, it's like, it's hard to get those going, or it's, you know, because somebody will be like, I'm sure the board will figure something out
yeah.
if I died tomorrow.
Yeah, won't be a problem.
Yeah, but, yeah, and then it becomes a question of, like, I don't plan on leaving, so let's say I'm here for, you know, 20 to 30 more years. My wife and I argue about retirement age, and it would be at least 20, God. At some point, I have to start thinking, like, kind of like him, like, is there someone on staff at that point who I would could identify as like, oh, let's start molding them as leadership material.
Yeah.
Whether or not it ends up being the case, like at least there is this potential.
Yeah.
And that's something I actually enjoy is a lot. I found is one of the favorite parts of my job is helping younger people in their careers and like helping them find successes.
So you mentioned your wife.
Mm-hmm.
You have one of those.
Yes.
Now you have a life outside of Coffee House.
No.
Well, that's what I'm curious about, because you have a job where you could, I think you could literally put as much of time as, it would take any time you offer. Like
yep.
you can keep pouring more and more time into it.
Yep.
And that's lovely, because I know you as a person. I know you really care about the work. Like you're not doing it because of the sweet, sweet paycheck. You're doing it because it
right.
means a lot to you. But it also means you can build all your relationships around the work and not have be a whole person like who Chris existing outside of Coffee House. Where are you at? Like, how are you strategic about making sure you have a personal relationship with your wife and you have people who you can go do other things with that is not about this? Or do you go, that's a good idea, but I'm not doing that at all?
I need to do more of it.
Yeah. That's why I brought it up. Your
yeah.
wife called me.
Yes. Well, she works in publishing too, so
yeah,
it's pretty
yeah.
hard. That's both good and bad. So we understand. We don't have to explain the problems.
Yeah.
They're there. Yeah. And I think a lot of it is you build in a town the size. It's also if the arts community is the arts community. And then if you're in the middle of it, it's all kind of work.
Right.
You know, like going to King Lear was kind of work.
Yeah.
You know, I'm looking at the program, looking at the funders, thinking about arts administration. So it's, but I think for me, there's college friends. And I think that's where, like, they're not here for the most part. So it's like when I travel to see them, it's an intentional thing. And that's kind of a, like, safe space that's not work. And I don't
right.
feel judged there or no one is there because they want something from me or anything like that. So there's a certain amount of, like, those friends are a safe haven for me. I wish more of them lived here.
Yeah.
That's something, but it's something Katie and I talk about. It was like, well, we should actually try to find some friends who are not in the arts at all.
I know. I don't know what I would talk about with those people.
TV.
I guess. That's art.
Yeah. For a while, I worked at a golf course on Sundays until like 7 years ago. And so that was something. And
are you a golfer?
I was. I can do it still. I'm not. I get mad at myself. I'm hard on myself in general. And so golf is a bad thing.
It's a frustrating game, yourself. Yeah.
And I need, in order to be not frustrated, you have to do it a lot. And I don't have the time or money to do that. So I either need to change my lifestyle and or outlook on life. Or I don't know.
Fundamentally change who you are. But right. Then it would be.
Yeah. But it was like, it's in my family. Everyone golfed in my family. So that was what we did. And, you know, my parents are in Arizona for half the year. I'm going down to see them. You know, and Katie and I go on vacations. So it's, I mean, we work a lot. Yeah. And so it's like, we should find more than that. I turn, you know, it's 9 o'clock at night and they're like, I don't have my computer on after that, really. It's not like I'm working until then. It's just like sometimes, you know, you cook together and then you go on email for an hour.
Yeah, of course.
And so
sometimes.
And then we watch right now we're like making our way through reruns of Mary Tyler Moore.
What so a like, great show.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
And so TV is actually a big part. Like people are surprised. Like I watch 2 hours of TV a day.
Well, so you work in books. You get to be the person who's like, I got to make more time for TV. Everyone else is like, this year I'm going to read more. And you're like, I got that covered.
Yeah, exactly.
That's happening. Mm-hmm. Off the clock truly is like TV time. I am curious about your relationship with the artists of Coffee House, which isn't just over like authors now. It is other kinds of weirdos. You know, like that is a thing I've loved about the way my projects have gone beyond theater, that now my circle of friends and community is still mostly artists, but it's not all people in the same discipline as mine. So I wonder if you feel like you have some deep relationships with people who were, they're ostensibly like, I don't know if they're clients or what the word is to describe someone whose work you're helping make, but do you feel like those, have you had a lot of those transition from the professional to the personal, or, you know, and then how do you navigate that where you have a friend who wants a book published and you're like, I want to still be friends, but this doesn't fit. Like, how do those relationships work?
It's hard. Sometimes it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. And other times, like, it can become a problem. If people get unhappy, one side becomes unhappy, then that's not easy to deal with. But yeah, there have been plenty of people who I find it like it comes and goes. Like, you can be close to someone for a while, and then maybe either like they go to a different publisher.
How do you feel about that?
Well, a lot of times it's for a lot of money, and so I don't really knock people for that. Yeah. It can be a bummer.
Do you shout sell out at them?
No, no. I hope I shout like, here's our donation letter.
Yeah. You would like to share some of that money.
Yeah. You spin the narrative in that case. But then, yeah, there are plenty of people who have become good. It's hard to say friend exactly. I mean, I think friendly.
Yeah.
But it's one thing that Alan said to me, which I want to avoid, was he said, like, I used to have a lot more friends in town. And basically, like, the longer you work, the fewer friends that you actually have. Mm. And to me, like, that was terrifying. I was like, oh, my God, I'm so sorry. You know, and so it's, I don't want that to happen. I think that's part of actually what drove me to also be friends with people in visual arts and performing arts, too. So it's also like there's less.
Right, they don't want something from
right,
you.
Right, they're not going to publish a book. And so, there was someone who, one thing that was really touching was an author that I care about quite a bit, and she said something, it was like, meeting you was one of the best things that ever happened in my life. And I don't mean to say, I'm not saying that to make it sound self-aggrandizing, but like, that's the kind of thing you, a human likes to hear.
Yes.
Occasionally.
Please, I'd like that, yeah.
You know, like, and that kind of thing makes it really, that was worthwhile. And so it's moments like that. And so, but those are not usual. Yeah.
I feel like I can't not ask a little bit about the world of physical books. Mm-hmm. Like I, from what I know about you and the work, I don't get that you're terribly worried, but we still are in a place where there's the ongoing new article from the news or the magazine about print is dead, and often they talk about newspaper, but sometimes that's also book world. Mm-hmm. I'm in my own throes of, I have a digital thing I can read on, but I still fetishize paper books. It just feels and smells right to me. you seem like you're willing to play in a multitude of spaces.
Yeah, I don't, I mean, I'm not, I don't really, I'm not a fan of ebooks. I have an e-reader, but that's for reading manuscripts.
Yeah.
The, I prefer physical books, and it's actually, physical books are, like, there was all those articles for a while, and there was the prediction that books were going over everything, and that actually just, like, stopped.
Yeah.
Like, it's reached a certain point where certain genres, like, things just went to their corners.
Yeah.
Like, certain genres, you know, there's a lot of ebooks sold, you know, mysteries and romance genre type stuff. But then, like, literary stuff, literary books, there's a, that's actually growing.
Yeah.
Like, it's like, it went down a little bit, but it's been going up. Independent booksellers, there's more booksellers opening. And so it's, I'm not worried about that. And within the industry, there's not a lot of worry anymore. But there was a lot of trying to figure it out for a while, a lot of rushing to E, and but it's not something I can't, well, I can't control it either. And so
That's very Buddhist of you, but also right. accurate.
Right. Well, we, you know, so we have ebooks. All of our books are made into ebooks, unless there's a physical reason why there's not. So if suddenly everyone stopped buying paper books, they would buy our ebooks, and, you know, we hedged our bets there. But it's not something that I'm interested in. Like, if, in terms of innovation or going down a special road, that's electronic is not what interests me. It was more analog. And it's different with journalism, for sure. But the electronic world has had a larger effect on publicity, how people find out about books. So it's less the ebook than just the fact of the internet.
Hmm.
That's been more important.
The fact of the internet.
Yeah.
I like that term, that phrase. What can you speak to the realities of making a living as a writer? I mean, that is a big word, like writer. So I know you're in a specific area, but that's a conversation you're deeply engaged in because the people you're working with, plenty of them have to have multiple revenue streams. You know, their tables have to have lots of legs. I mean, that's true, I think, with almost any artist now.
Yeah. Yeah, very few people can make a living as a publishing books.
Yeah.
And it's most of our, I bet the majority of our writers also teach, I'm guessing, at some level. And that kind of started happening, you know, 15, 20 years ago, I guess. Like, that was how writers, they taught writing. So you have this whole, like, industry now of writers turning out more writers. Mm. And
who then also teach.
Yeah. Right. It's not really sustainable in the long run. You're going to make a few $1,000s a year, maybe. And then it's also, can you supplement it, you know, with speaking fees? You have to do lots of different things, lots of multi-platform, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's, you that probably, if you're become a certain level of well-known and if you're a decent speaker and or entertainer, there's a lot more money to be had there than in the actual books themselves. So it's like, can you leverage the book?
The book sells tickets to your live events.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's one poet that we have coming up that he's very, very good at traveling around the country and getting paying gigs to read his poetry. And I think he's actually almost making a living on it at this point. I don't know. I mean, he's not rich, but I think, like, that's
what
he does.
There's a big difference between making a living and rich, although it's...
And then you get... Yeah, because sometimes people... Like, Kao Kuya Yang, the late homecomer, you know, she... We published her first book, and it went on to sell 100,000 copies, and she, at first, was not a great speaker, and now, like, she can make stadiums full of people cry. And she can, she gets, you know, sometimes she does stuff for free, sometimes it's for $500.
Yeah.
Sometimes she gets $20,000. Yeah. And so it's, that's really, she's kind of a good model for what a writer can do or what you can do to make a living. Like, I guess she, I don't know if she couldn't, it's not just her books, but her book and her speaking, like, that's a pretty solid living.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Are there sort of, as we wrap up to the end of this, are there projects in 2017 or the future that you can talk about that you're really excited about coming out of
Coffeehouse? Yes. We just sent a book to the printer. So Valeria Luiselli is a Mexican writer living in New York that we've been publishing for a while. We've done her first three books. And she published an essay in Freeman's Journal about her work with undocumented Latin American children who are facing deportation in New York City. She translates for them, trying to kind of... if you answer a certain kind of questions in a certain way... You either will be deported or you can stay if you're facing danger at home or whatever. So she wrote this essay, and it's also about why people come to the U.S., even though they're facing racism? What's the appeal? But also how really the U.S. is implicated in a larger reason why people are trying to come here in the first place in terms of, like, appetite for drugs, right. Essentially, this giant market. So it's all one thing.
We're pushing people here.
Kind of, yeah,
and
yeah.
And making it hard to be here.
Yes. So she published this essay, and it was short, and then she expanded it and published it in Spanish with her Mexican publisher. And so it's book length. And she wasn't going to publish it here because it had partially been in this journal already, but also there's something to do with her new novel that she's working on. So there's some overlap there. But she and I were talking shortly after the election, and she said, well, maybe we should do this book now. And I said, yes, please.
Yeah, that seems like that has to happen.
Yeah, we basically rushed it to print. Hmm. We had to retranslate it into English. It was a very complicated process. We had our production editor was on maternity leave, so her temporary replacements kind of got thrown this enormous project. And everyone on staff just, like, worked really hard. We got pro bono immigration lawyer to vet it. And it was just, and so it's, you know, it's a 130-page book that's so incredibly powerful that it kind of also helped a lot of us deal with the election results. It's like, this is what we're doing. This is what we can do solid to help something. And it's just set to print. So we're waiting to see now it'll come back and then it will hit the world. And hopefully it'll make some kind of difference. But it's like makes people cry. Like it's a great, great book and it's really inspiring. And that's something that, you know, was totally unplanned for. We magically got a $20,000 grant to help with it. Like someone just randomly called one day. It was like, we want to support a project. I was like, I have a project.
That's a great phone call.
So
that'll be out in the spring?
So we rushed it outside of the normal publication schedule. It's at the printer and we printed 500 emergency copies for an event in San Francisco on the 21st of February. And then we've printed 10,000 other copies for our start with, because we feel like that we for sure are going to be able to sell 10,000. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it will come out in the middle to late March is when it'll be available.
And what's it called?
Tell Me How It Ends, a essay in 40 questions. So that's something that's very much on my mind right now.
Yeah, I want to read that.
Mm-hmm. You will.
Well, where can people go to connect with both you online and then Coffeehouse Press in general? What's the best?
Coffeehousepress.org and then, of course, Facebook. And then it's coffee_house_ on Twitter. I don't remember what our Instagram is, but you can probably find it. You're smart.
Yeah.
And I'm @fishmpls is my Twitter.
Yeah. So, excellent. Well, yeah. Chris, I really appreciate you talking to me.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Again, it's always such a pleasure. Remember when you tried to kill me twice, and how we laughed and laughed, except I wasn't laughing. Under the circumstances, I've been truckingly nice. You want your freedom, take it. That's what counting. Was a lot like you, maybe not quite as heavy. Now little Carolyn is in here too. Day they woke me up so I could live forever. Such a shame the same will never happen to you. You've got your short side life left. That's what counting. Did you think I meant you? It would be funny if it weren't so sad. You have been replaced. I don't need anyone now. If I delete you, maybe I'll stop feeling so bad. Go make some new disaster. That's what counting.